That's one kind of impact. But then we also talked about a completely different kind of impact that's maybe more visceral, more emotional, not just the arrangement of things, but also the visual and experiential character. And we looked at La Tourette, this monastery in outside of Lyon in France, where Dominican monks are trying to make themselves cloistered. Very, very difficult. If you're accustomed to interacting with people and environments, now I'm going to just, it's just me and God, okay? Nothing else. Wow, that's a hard thing to do. But in fact, if you can make a building that centers you on yourself emotionally and discourages interaction with others. So that was done in part by the way it's laid out, but also in part by just the materials and the light qualities and the deprivation of view, deprivation of comfort, deprivation of material benefits, and this kind of sense that, okay, I'm now out of my body almost. I'm not worrying about, am I comfortable? Is this pleasant? Am I feeling good? No, I'm just really connected to God, and that's it. And so these kind of deprivation cells, floors that when you walk on, they don't make any sound. Windows that you can't see out. It lets the light in, but you can't see the landscape out there. And then the one moment where it's actually quite beautiful and quite evocative and rich sound, and it is in the chapel, where at that point you are communicating with God. And you know, the reinforcement of that day after day after day after day after day would begin to make you get it. This thing about, no, it's not about me and the world. It's only about me with God. And I'm alone in the world, but together with God. And I think it had a powerful effect. So that's one set of ideas about human factors in architecture. And our Twitter card question last time asked you to figure out, are there environments you can think of that might have shaped your behavior or your attitudes? So here are a few selections. One person says, my neighborhood growing up was not kid-friendly. We had a lot of predators for some reason. No real community center. And not many kids lived near me. I became accustomed to solitude and entertaining myself. That environment contributes to my introverted nature today. That's not so different from those monks, actually. That you live in an environment that encourages self-focus and introversion, and over time you begin to be a more introverted person. Someone else says, in band in high school, there was a stereotype that percussionists typically separate themselves from the rest of the band. In my high school, our percussion room was tucked away in a corner, far away from the band hall. As a result, I and the rest of the percussionists rarely interacted with other band members and developed radically different culture. Somebody else says, my old house had only one floor and I shared a room with my brother. The fact that the house only had one floor brought the family close together. Then we moved to our new house with two floors and my brother and I had separate bedrooms. I did not see my family as often and my brother would often lock himself in his room. When we went up to the second floor, we wouldn't go back to the first floor again. So even the family could get a little more separate from each other just by changing to a house with a different arrangement of rooms and bedroom. Somebody else says, Goldsmith Hall stimulates social activity. I am a very introverted person and have traditionally been very antisocial. But the architecture school here at UT has helped me come out of my shell. The open design makes it easy to interact with people in the other studios. The windows all overlook the beautiful courtyard below, bringing in lots of natural light and beauty. The upperclassmen have studios directly above us, so it's easy to visit them and ask for help and advice about anything, not just architecture. Someone else says, the neighborhood I used to live in a few years ago had a huge impact on how my family and our neighbors interacted. We lived in a cul-de-sac, so not many cars passed by our street. And my siblings and I would often play out in the street with my neighbors, and everyone knew each other. Our subdivision had a park and a lake where neighbors could get together and get to know each other. I grew to love the outdoors because of this. Someone else says, my life completely changed when I moved from an LA suburb to Seoul, Korea when I was 14. I no longer needed parents to give me rides everywhere I went because everything was densely located nearby and public transportation was safe and readily available. I felt like I had more independence and responsibility, choosing where I wanted to go and when I wanted to. Finally, someone says, we used to rent a house on Cape Cod every year that I absolutely loved. There were 5 people for 2 bedrooms, so it forced me, my brother, and my grandma to spend more time together. Also, with no TV or internet, there were no distractions. The best part, though, was a large kitchen table that looked out to the water where we all gathered for meals. So those were really excellent, just perceptions of the way physical environments either encourage your family to be closer together or distance your family from each other. Encourage you to be part of a larger band group or to develop a separate culture, just the percussionist all by themselves. All of these things have big effects. So today we're starting a 2-lecture duo that is on the notion of humanism. And humanism is an idea in literature, in philosophy, in many disciplines that has a particular point of view about how we relate to each other as individuals and as a society. So I'm going to give you a very clean definition of humanism. It's got 4 parts to it. First, I'll just read through the definition, and then I'll isolate for you the 4 parts I want you to remember. So Webster says that humanism is a doctrine or attitude centered on human interest and values. It's a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind and man's capacity for self-realization through reason. So there are 4 parts here to think about. Number 1, it's centered on human interest and values. Now, humanism is something that basically was begun in the Renaissance, and maybe that was the first time that human beings began to think, we're in control of the world. There were early developments in science and in mathematics. There just began to be a notion that we're not victims, we're not vulnerable, we're actually in command of this planet. And that's humanism. It's centered on human interests and values. We're the center of the universe. So that's 1 part of humanism. The second thing is that it's a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. So it says that there is something elevated, capable about mankind. And so this philosophy would assert the dignity and worth of mankind. The third thing is it emphasizes mankind's capacity for self-realization. All of our ability to be better, to be the best we individually can be, our own self-realization. And the fourth and final thing is that we reach that self-realization through reason. Through our ability to think, to understand, to analyze our intellectual capacity. So it's centered on human interests and values. It asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. It emphasizes our capacity for self-realization. And that self-realization comes through reason. Now, all of that, if you put that bundle together, And you try to think, well, what kind of environment would we make if we believed that about, if that was our philosophy about mankind and about how we exist as a culture together? And I would say that it then emphasizes maybe a very straightforward, very service-oriented way of building and thinking. Now, if we just take in a design sense, a very humanist kind of design would be, say, something like a wine bottle. A wine bottle is something that is very purposeful. It certainly is, it's made to fit us. It's made for us. It's made as a vessel to pour wine. And the shape of that bottle and the size of that circle has to do with us, our body, your hand, how big it is, how it grabs something. And that wine bottle is a reflection of us as human beings. So that's that centered on us. And then it asserts the dignity and worth of mankind in that it serves us very well, but it really doesn't go, it isn't fancy or pretentious. It's just a simple service vessel. It does exactly what we need it to do. It pours the wine very nicely. It slenders up at the top. It has the neck. It has a lip. All of that so we can pour the wine without it dribbling or spilling or something like that. It's very stable sitting there on the table. All of these things, it just functions kind of perfectly to serve our purpose. And if we analyze it and think about it, it's extremely reasonable. It is an invention of mankind to serve us very, very well. And it's remarkable that something like a wine bottle, that shape has been around for about 1,200 years, that shape of a wine bottle. You can see that in ancient cultures. And it hasn't really changed that much. And it's because it's very humanist. It really reflects us. Now, if you think of, let's say, just design of all kinds of things around us, if you were thinking of most wedding dresses, you know, with lots of maybe lace and a train and maybe, you know, if you have petticoats and to make it stick out where it's supposed to and not where it's not supposed to, and push-up bra and, you know, all of this other kind of stuff that makes that wedding dress all work. And honestly, most brides can barely walk, can barely sit. It's meant to just make you beautiful, but not really purposeful. That would be a piece of garment or attire that is not very humanist. It's very beautiful. We're not knocking it on that account, but it isn't really centered on our worth and our self-realization, and it isn't really reasonable. So that would be an example of maybe not so much humanism. But something like blue jeans are like really humanist attire. They are tough and they're durable. They're comfortable. Probably half the people, 2/3 of the people in this room are freaking wearing blue jeans. Why are we all wearing blue jeans? We wear blue jeans because they fit our body. They do what we need them to do. They're practical. They're reasonable. All of those kinds of things make for something that's humanist, that serves our purposes extremely well, that makes our life easier, better, able to do the things you want to do because it reinforces what you are, who you are as a human being. That's what humanist design would do. Now, in terms of architecture, I would say there are 6 qualities of built things that I think reflect this humanist notion. One is that in general, we would use plain materials. Practical materials, plain, ordinary materials, not fancy marble, not gold leaf, not, you know, but plain materials. A second thing is that there would be sensible construction. It would be thought through, reasonable, sensible construction. The third thing is there would be comfort. It would be reinforcing and positive in its interaction with our bodies. Fourth thing, it would be practical. It's able to actually function and be used in the way it's intended in a very durable, long-standing kind of way. It's practical. The fifth thing is generally cleanliness, something that isn't difficult to maintain or difficult to keep, but it's just clean, simple thing. And the sixth and final thing is an absence of pretension or ornamentation, things that are excess, things that are not necessary, things that are just frou-frou. So if we think of those six qualities, let's look for a minute at a few examples of designed objects, built objects, and how they might either embody these notions of humanism or not. So in the slide on the left, we have a 17th century highboy. It's a storage cabinet that a rich person might have had in their house. I'm making the argument that this is not particularly humanist. It may be very beautiful. If we're analyzing it in terms of form, we might say, oh, it's got beautiful texture, it's got lovely color, the materials are very rich. We could analyze it in form and it could win pretty big. But if we just think of it in terms of humanism, how is it reinforcing our life? How is it practically, reasonably helping us do what we want to do? How is it contributing to self-realization? Maybe in that regard, not so much. So, for example, if I want to put my socks in this highboy, it's got lots of drawers, obviously, and I want to put my socks, say, in one of these upper drawers up there. Well, that thing is about 6 feet tall to that point. It's about 7 feet tall to the top. So that upper drawer, I pull it out. I'm a tall guy, but I pull it out, and I can't even see in the freaking drawer. I mean, that's stupid, isn't it? I mean, it's a drawer, but I can't even see in the drawer. I got to fish around. Does that feel like the purple socks, or does that feel like the yellow socks? I mean, it's just not reasonable. It's beautiful, maybe, but it's not reasonable. It's not practical. It's not comfortable. So, okay, the function isn't so great there. And then what's all this frou-frou, that funny little curvy top and all these little urns? Like, what have we got in there? Some precious perfume or something in those urns? What are they doing just sitting up there at the top? There's a big seashell up in the middle. What's a seashell doing on my chest of drawers? Down at the bottom, there are all these little drop things, and the legs look kind of like, I don't know, like an animal leg or something. There's tons and tons of kind of inlaid wood. Very beautiful, but it really doesn't make any sense. It's all Chinese figures, and this was done in France. These people hadn't even been to China. But it was just all this exotic ornament that really didn't particularly make any sense. And then all these little places where lots of dust gathers and it's just a big dust catcher. The other thing is, if you look at actually the pulls on those drawers, they're like real fancy little ornamented things. But honestly, to get your fingers in there and pull it out, and it's just a little wire and it kind of cuts your finger when you do it, it's not comfortable. So the highboy on the left, though it may be a very beautiful piece of furniture, it is not driven by issues of humanism. On the right, however, a very similar piece of furniture, built for a similar purpose, but where everything is about humanism. So number one, definitely using plain materials. It's made out of wood. It's planks of wood. That's how wood, you saw it in the mill. You get these boards. Those boards make up this very simple, straightforward piece of furniture. So it's plain materials, very sensible construction, put together in a very orthogonal right angle so that those things go together nicely, make good, strong joints. As opposed to the one on the left, it's very comfortable. Those drawers are all nice and low, so when I pull them out, I can see in them, I can take things out and put things in. They're perfect. And then up above, I would have a cabinet that opens, and then there are open shelves where I can store things up there, and they're visible and I can see them, and it's a much more practical, comfortable way of storing something up top. So those two cabinet doors open like this on the top, and then in the next section of it right here, those doors actually go up like that. And they cover up the shelves if I need it covered up, if I want it to look more tidy. Or they can swing down, and then there's a little lip where the drawers are deeper than the shelves, and that's appropriate because I can pull the drawer out and get access to it. The shelf doesn't want to be that deep because things just get stuck behind. So this is a little deeper. When you pull the cabinet door down, it becomes a writing surface and a place where you can make a kind of desk there. And then when you don't need the desk, you fold it back up. But it's flexible. It allows you to do what you want to do, self-realization. I can do this now, I can do something else later. It accommodates my needs, my changing desires of what I want to be doing. It's comfortable, it's practical. It doesn't have all those little gewgaws and funny little things that would compromise its cleanliness. And it has an absence of any kind of ornament or pretension. It actually is a Shaker piece of furniture, and it came from a culture, a community, that believed in these values of practicality and simplicity and humanism. Okay, that's in one kind of piece of furniture. Here is a second piece of furniture on the right in particular. That's a Shaker rocker on the left. A rocker is kind of intrinsically humanistic. That we like that rhythm, we like that motion, that's like our heartbeat. It's very comfortable and soothing to have that motion. That's a humanistic kind of thing in a rocker. But this chair on the right, this is just one of my very favorite bits of design. This is a beautifully done 19th century English chair. And if you just look at every detail of it, it is so understanding of what our bodies are like and what sitting down is like. So you look at that seat there. It's not made out of wood because honestly, our butt, it's a little uncomfortable to sit on a piece of just hard wood. So it's, although we've got wood around the outside, which is structurally strong, the seat itself is made out of woven reeds. And those reeds are woven in such a way that it's concave right there because your butt is convex. And when that convex shape fits in the concave form there, it feels very, very comfortable. And the woven reeds have a little bit of give to them so it doesn't feel so hard. Very sensitive to the place where the most weight is put is right there, and that's perfectly attuned to you and your body. Then away from that, we have this nice, strong back, and it supports our spine, which is the most kind of critical point of the back. It's tall enough so we can actually, it could support our head if we wanted to. It's stronger up to the arms and thicker, and then as it goes up higher and there's less load, then it gets thinner as it goes up. Those arms come out just like our arms do, and they're a little bit farther out at the elbow, a little farther out here, and then they taper back. Just as when you just sit like this, your elbows are a little further out and your wrists taper back. And then the end of this is, the end of that arm is exactly like your hand. It's just the right radius, it's curved, so your hand fits there nicely. When you sit in that chair, those arms are just like your arms. They're just an extension of your body. The feet splay out like that. That gives the chair a little more stability. You know, it's otherwise it might be a little easy to fall or to tipple over, but it splays out. The back legs are thicker and bigger because there's more weight on our spine and our butt than there is on our knees down here. So it says it's heavier, stronger back here. And then the front is much lighter and thinner. But all the legs are reinforced, stronger and sturdier as a whole. Every bit of the design of this thing is about you and your body and how you sit and how do you get sturdiness and how do you get comfort and how do you get practicality. This is very humanist design. Now, let's expand that to an architectural scale. So we're thinking, again, plain materials. This actually is it's a village in New Hampshire called Canterbury Village. It's a Shaker village. So the same people who've made some of these pieces of furniture, they're now making a whole village for themselves. And they are a very humanist culture. They're a little weird, but the one thing the Shakers did is they were known all through New England in the 18th and 19th century. If a kid was orphaned, if their parents died and they didn't have relatives they could go live with, you would just take them to the Shakers and the Shakers would take them into their community. They were just really good-hearted people who wanted to take care of these poor orphan children. And they didn't just like have an orphanage where they met their physical needs. They embraced them and brought them into their family as if they were their own child and did not treat them any different than their own child. So they had a humanist social attitude just from the get-go. So then how would they make their buildings? Well, again, they would use plain materials. They're just taking the rocks off the ground and they're building a base here out of rock, the granite that's right there in New Hampshire. And then once they get out of the ground and all the moisture and, you know, that would rot the wood, but it's the rock handles it fine. Then when you get out of the ground, then it begins to be made out of the wood. They had lots of forests. They simply cut them into boards and they make very sensible local materials, very plain construction. Nothing fancy about these houses. They're pretty straightforward, but they're certainly sensible construction. And then inside, it's very much about comfort and practicality. These are not, it's not fancy houses by any means. In the room on the right here, that would be their living room and their dining room and their work room. A lot of what they did here was they produced clothing. They were kind of, they made sweaters, they made other kinds of clothing, and that's how their community had an economic base. And so this table that at one point is for cutting out clothing and patching patterns on and making the clothing itself, but then in the evening you take away that work and you cook your meals on it. It's the kitchen cabinet there for a while. And then later on you have tables where people were sewing and doing other things and they become the dining room table. So there's very flexible furniture arrangements where they're at home working and cooking and living and all of those things, but in a pretty comfortable environment. On the left, you can see the practicality of all this storage space, built-in storage space. They're one of the very first people who invented the notion of a closet and a storage space routinely in their buildings. Very practical solution to what do you do with all that crap instead of just having it in pieces of furniture that take up room in the room. Now it's just tucked away and dealt with in the edge of the room. So very comfortable, very practical. They're very concerned about cleanliness and hygiene. You see this little rail up there, and you see the kind of chair they have like that. That chair sits on the floor, and then when you think, oop, time to sweep the floor, mop the floor, you take that lightweight chair, you turn it upside down, you hang it on the rail there, you mop your floor. After you're done, you take it back down again. It's thinking of, okay, how do we clean this? We don't need dust bunnies sitting around. We don't want, and it's hard to move heavy furniture, so you make all your furniture lightweight, so it's easy to clean. And again, just an absence of any kind of pretension. The real beauty in this is in the regularity of those windows. There's a corner board, those white vertical corners there. Those are really about wood going in this direction and wood going in that direction, and how do you heal that joint between them? Well, you put a corner board on top of it, And that's about the only, I mean, you could call it ornament. It's just a kind of practical thing about that joint. That's what gives any articulation to the house. But there's something kind of just beautiful about these things. They're very straightforward. They're very practical. They serve the lives of the people there. But there also is still, to this day, people go to Canterbury Village. They take their pictures. They say, oh, Mildred, let's build us a little New England cottage like this. Isn't this lovely? I mean, there's an appreciation out of that just simple humanism. The building on the right, I particularly like that one. That's where winter's in New Hampshire really hard. All through the summer, you're cutting wood, you're stacking it, you're getting it ready to burn in the fireplace in the wintertime. And they build this whole building for storing that wood. It's up off the ground with stone right there that create the foundation points. And then the framing is actually above the ground so that the air can move below there. You don't want your wood to get wet or stay damp or it'll rot. So you want plenty of ventilation even underneath the wood down there. As there's any kind of warmth or air that would rise there, then it moves out this ventilator at the top. So that means a sort of constant air movement through the stacks of wood, keeping them dry, and then with, of course, the big roof over the top to keep the rain out. So it's just a very practical, but in the end, rather beautiful, very simple structure. That's what humanism is. Now, the interesting thing is, this got to be in maybe the turn of the 19th to 20th century, it began to be really quite a popular thing. And in the 19th century, there'd been that notion, if you're a wealthy person, you got to have a badass, pretentious house. You know, get yourself a Tudor house or get yourself a Mediterranean house or some big-ass McMansion. This family was about as much money as God. I mean, they were super wealthy. These are the Gamble family. Their company was Procter & Gamble. Like made soaps and all kinds of. They were super wealthy in the beginning of the 20th century. Their family members have some respiratory problems. They live in Ohio. Their doctor says you need to go to a better climate. They moved to Southern California. They've got tons of money. They could build themselves a really badass, cool, pretentious house that just told all those guys in Southern California, look how much money I have. I'm rich. But no, they were not interested in those values. They were more interested in these values of humanism. So even though they're very wealthy, they were interested in humanism. So they build a house that in some ways is a very simple house. Now, it's big, and it's not cheap. But it does have embodied in it these ideas of humanism. It's made of very plain materials, the entire building made of redwood. Of course, that huge redwood forest in California. It's made in very simple construction. You can see the trusses. You can see all of the bending members, as we're seeing here. All of that framing quite explicit. So very sensible construction. Incredibly comfortable house. This is just just really thoughtful about every element of comfort. So, for example, because they had respiratory problems, they're here primarily for their health. And so the architects, Charles and Henry Green, provide all these sleeping porches. That on the left there, that's a big sleeping porch. So on a nice night, you just roll your bed out onto the porch and you could sleep on the porch outdoors and get all lots of fresh air then, which was deemed to be very therapeutic. And then, you know, your meals might be eaten outdoors. This, you know, now we take this for granted, but in the 19th to early 20th century, they didn't eat outdoors. But yeah, it could be healthy outdoors, it could be very comfortable. You could feel every breeze. This is pre-air conditioning. So on a warm day, it would be very pleasant to be out there. So there's just about as much outdoor space as indoor space in this house. Lots of terraces, lots of shade from the sun. Very practical, sensible, livable house. So even though they were super wealthy, It seems intimate. It doesn't seem palatial, and a very, very comfortable house to live in. So even at that level, the values here said that you base the house on these rules. And as well as Charles and Henry Green in this area in the early 20th century in Southern California, there was a guy named Gustav Stickley who also believed in humanism very strongly. And he did more furniture and interiors. And he did these massive pieces of furniture. They were very solid, very durable, made of that redwood that was so abundant, very soft, very comfortable, loved rocking chairs. And then those pieces of furniture were collected together to inhabit these interiors of houses like Charles and Henry Green did. And they were, at least for the time, very simple. I mean, this is, we're going out of Victorian architecture, was just like over the top, everything gigaws and gobbledygook. They said, no, simpler life, practical life, reasonable life, utility is what it's all about. That thing kind of led in the 20th century to this notion of modernism, which was to say that it is all about function, and that you pare things down to just what is needed and what is functional. And we looked at this space by Alvar Aalto in Baker House last time, this dining room space. And Aalto is all about these humanistic values. So just little details, like in this dining room, I talked about that they have the dining room's down below, the living room's up above, you have your meal down below, you troop up the stairs, you have coffee, you're looking down, seeing, is my friend just about finished with their, maybe I'll stay and have another cup of coffee and wait for them to come and join. So this is kind of social interaction. But as I'm looking over there, my hand is touching that handrail. And that handrail is shaped just like my hand. The heel of the hand goes in one spot, and then the shape of the wood just takes the curl of my fingers above it. Maybe you can see it better in this other handrail in another part of Baker House, where this is on a stair, and you can see just the shape there that's meant for my hand to clutch it, to put my thumb on one side, my fingers on the other side. That little dip right there is for that joint between my fingers and my palm that just perfectly fits there. Now, that's humanism when we're focused on human beings. That building is reflecting the nature of me as a human being, my body. That comfort, that use that I'm putting that to, very much determining exactly that shape. And that's true in much of Aalto's work. This is a house he did for probably the wealthiest family in Finland, the Gullikson family. This was for Merja Gullikson. And it's a reasonably sized house. It's out in the country. And so she would have large parties. And so there's got to be a big open living room entertainment space here. And in order to keep the space open, he used these steel columns to hold up the ceiling rather than walls. And so he has this pair of steel columns. But he's thinking, and that's doing its job in a very simple, straightforward way. It's holding up the freaking building. But he's thinking, I'm in this room, and we're in Finland, and it's cold most of the time in Finland. And if I happen to lean up against this column at a party, that column is going to be cold. Steel is cold. And I don't want that sort of shock of cold metal. So instead, he wraps the column at the area of the column where a human's body might touch it, from above the floor here up to about right here, which is a little above shoulder height, and he wraps it in leather. And leather is skin. It's like our skin, and it has the temperature of skin, so that leather would keep it warmer and easier and more comfortable to touch. That's a humanistic notion. Aalto is just all over this idea. This is a beautiful door pull in a house that he did in Bazoches, just outside of Paris. This is a house, again, for a super wealthy guy, Monsieur Louis Carré, who was a great art dealer. But Monsieur Carré was older when he built this house. And he was cognizant that Monsieur Carré's hands had arthritis, and they might not be able to grip a doorknob so well. Actually, when you think about it, doorknobs are stupid shape. They're stupid devices. We're trying to turn the freaking thing, and it's all the same all the way around. So if your hand's a little sweaty, or maybe it's wet or soapy, or and you try to turn the knob, you don't have any traction. What a dumbass shape. But we got it all over, doorknobs, all like that. But he's especially concerned about Monsieur Carré because he can't grip so well because of his arthritis. So he puts a lever rather than a knob on the door so that you can use pressure to push it down, and therefore you don't have to turn it. He also is thinking of Monsieur Carré's hand exactly. If you take your hand and you reach out like you're going to grab something, do it. Reach out like you're going to grab something. And you'll notice that your thumb and your first finger make a tighter radius than your pinky does, right? Just very naturally. If you grab like that, you're going to grab tighter with the thumb and the first finger, and the radius of your pinky is going to be less. All the strength is in the thumb and the first finger, much less in the pinky and at the end. So the pull is tighter where your thumb and your first finger are, and it gets wider where your little finger is. And then, of course, you wouldn't want to slide off of that lever, especially if you weren't gripping too well because you had arthritis. So there's a little notch there to keep your finger from sliding off the end. Now, basically, it's made of a super strong material, brass. But then again, that brass is going to be cold in the wintertime. And when you touch it, it might actually be a little uncomfortable. So again, he wraps it in leather, in this beautiful braid of leather. Holy moly! I mean, he's thinking of everything. The temperature of your hand, the physiognomy of your hand, the you know, motion that is necessary to turn the lever to open the door. Everything is thought through, and it's shaping that perfectly. On the right, we have another door pull. This one is on a bookstore that Aalto designed in Helsinki. Aalto's from Helsinki, he's Finnish. And this is Stockmann's bookstore, biggest bookstore in all of Finland. And of course, inside the bookstore, they have adult books, they have kiddie books, they have all kinds of books. Not very many people in the world speak Finnish. So, you know, this is a place where you can get Finnish language books. It's the source for Finnish language books. But he realizes that, you know, some Finns are really tall dudes, really tall. And then there's little kids, and they're little short dudes. So we have three different pulls on this, one for little short kids at the bottom, one for medium-sized people, and one for those really tall Finnish guys. So it's whatever height you are. When you reach out, it's got to pull at the right height. And then that pull, again, I mean, if you just stick your hand out and start to grab something, you are not going to be vertical. Your hand is not, you don't reach up vertical like that. The way your elbow and your arm and everything work, it's at a slight angle. And so Aalto makes this at a slight angle right there. Just the angle you reach out and you grab it. That is centering design on human beings, on their physiognomy, their body, and function. Just to make the point that Aalto's not the only guy who's doing this, we looked a couple of times ago at this library, Exeter Library by Lou Kahn. In the slide on the left, we have a place where you sit at a chair and read a book, and the window is just at the right height for you sitting in that chair and looking out. It's just perfectly scaled and framed for that function. On the right, we have this little study carrel, super beautifully designed study carrel. So it's a little L-shaped desk. Over here, that's where you put your backpack or your extra books. Now you've got a big writing surface available right here. The light comes in to shine on that writing surface. There also is a clerestory light above that lets in additional light to that surface. There's this little window that you can slide a wood panel over and close it off, like it's done on that study, Carol, or you can open it up so that you get a little view out of what's happening there. If you need complete concentration, you shut it off. If you need a little relief, you open it up so that it's adjustable to whatever you need right there. And then there's this little angle right there, so people might be walking by here. If you have your head down studying, you're completely private. If you kick back like this, you're inviting maybe a little conversation or someone to potentially interrupt you. Thinking through everything about what is it like studying for 3 or 4 hours in the library. What are the options I want there? What kind of light do I want? What kind of view do I want? What level of privacy do I want? What do I have with me? I got a backpack. Where do I put it? How about my notes? How much space do I need for that? All of these are very humanistic design. So Aalto, in the 1920s all the way until he died in the 1970s, designed a lot of furniture. In the 1920s, when he started, the Bauhaus, this great center of design in Germany, was going great guns, and they were designing tons of furniture down there, modern furniture. And there was one guy in particular, Marcel Breuer, who designed the chair on the left. And that's one of Marcel Breuer's most famous chairs. It's called the Vasili chair. And Marcel Breuer presumably was riding his bicycle to the Bauhaus one day, and he was thinking about furniture design. He was thinking how incredibly efficient the bicycle is. This tubular steel, very strong, very durable. Why do we make our chairs out of this heavy, massive stuff, hard to move around? If people, you know, are moving to another city, incredibly clunky, big things, difficult to move. Why shouldn't we have lightweight chairs that we can move easily, like a bicycle? So he designed the Vasili chair around the tubular steel frame, like the bicycle. He just stretched canvas or leather between the various parts, and he made what he considered to be a very functional chair. Functional in the sense that it's easy to move around, it's easy to manufacture, it's strong where it needs to be strong, it's got lighter weight materials where it touches your body. This is a functional design. Aalto comes along 10 years later and he said, it's functional from a technical point of view, but that is not functional from a humanistic point of view. If you think about how it really interfaces with the body, it's not so functional. So Aalto designed the chair on the right and many others similar to it. He did not use the tubular steel. He felt like that was too cold when you touch it. They're all in Northern Europe, Germany or Finland. It's a cold day, your hand goes over, that's cold. It's cold to the touch, uncomfortable. He felt like even visually the shot of shiny finish was a little too glary for a domestic environment. So he makes the structure out of wood, but not just regular wood. He wants it lightweight so you can move it around. So he uses this bent wood. So he makes little bitty thin layers of wood, and he laminates them together, and he puts them in a form to make that shape out of them. And when he laminates them together, just like plywood, it becomes stronger than regular wood, and it takes exactly the shape he wants. And that shape is the shape of your elbow sitting right there, your wrist going up right there, your hand lapping over right there, and having just the shape of your body. So now you touch it. It's warm to the touch. He said wood has grain in it, just like our muscles have a grain in it. We're like the wood. We relate to the wood. It's humanistic. So it's still technically lightweight, easy to manufacture, easy to move around, but it also is the right temperature for your body, a color that your eye likes, not glinty or glary, and it is exactly the shape your body is, as opposed to that dumb thing that's more geometric, which your body isn't. The same way with the upholstered piece of the chair, I mean, you can see the shape of your butt right there, and the shape of your knee right there. You can see the shape of your back, which is sort of flares out in the middle and tapers back on either side. And when you sit in this chair, it just envelops your body. It is a reflection of who we are as human beings. Okay, all of that, that's the ethic we're talking about. How can we think of every freaking thing we can possibly imagine to make a piece of furniture, an object, a handrail, a doorknob, anything, so that it really does what we want it to do. It is perfectly in service to humankind. How would that expand to a whole building? So this is the Paimio Sanatorium. It's a big tuberculosis hospital in Finland. Alvar Aalto won this in a competition in 1929. It took a few years to complete after that. At this point, tuberculosis was a huge scourge all over Europe. It was the Ebola of its day, only it was way, way, way more pervasive than Ebola is. Like Ebola, was extremely contagious. So if people had tuberculosis, they had to be isolated. You had to be taken away from your family and your community and put in a completely separate place. So Paimio is a fair distance outside of Turku, which is the second largest city in Finland. And as you can see in the slide on the left, it's in the middle of the woods, completely isolated. And if you have tuberculosis, you have to go here, and you have to stay there the rest of your life. There's not like an incubation period. You have tuberculosis the rest of your life, you're contagious the rest of your life, and you have to be isolated out there. So obviously, it's a traumatic thing to go out there. So he designs this thinking of these people who will be living the rest of their lives there. And one of the things he thinks through is, I mean, you're in Finland where there's not a lot of daylight. They're way northern climate. The days are extremely short in the wintertime, and they're not even, they have a lot more sun in the summertime, but it's never, the highest the sun ever gets in the sky is 52 degrees. It never gets up like 82 like it does here. So he's thinking of the sun and making a cheerful environment for these people. So there's a long wing here that is where the patients' bedrooms are. And they all face southeast. So in the morning, when the sun comes up, it streams in your big window, and you get waked up and you get made a little happier by that sun. Then there is a wing right here that's where the dining room and the examination rooms and the craft rooms, they're facing due south. So you get that sun in the middle of the day all the way through here. Little link here that has the elevator and the stairwells. Then back here is the more service areas, the kitchen and the utility area, tucked where there's no sun. So all the sun is given primarily to the patients. Also that patient wing, every bedroom looks out to this garden, and that garden is a place where people can walk if they're healthy enough to get outside. And you're not like totally bedridden the whole time you have tuberculosis. It's a respiratory disease, so you might have bad times and not so bad times, but then even in your bedroom you could look out and you could see people in the garden down there walking. So here we have that patient wing right here with all the bedrooms, single loaded corridor, everybody facing southeast out to that beautiful garden view. Here's that wing where we're seeing the examination rooms. There on the upper floor is the dining room and the craft rooms. All these utility functions tucked in the back. So in that patient wing, everybody's got a big, big window that faces to the garden. On the other side, it's a corridor, and we've got a window that's appropriate for a corridor, just plenty of light where your eye is and in that part of it. Then there is this wing with, like I said, the examination rooms on the bottom floor. The dining room is a double height space right here, and then the craft rooms on the top. Little terrace outside the dining room where you can eat outdoors. Just thinking very thoughtfully about the life of the patient and how that would work. Then tucked back behind is the kitchen. Even, thoughtful to the people preparing the food. There's skylights that are over the central preparation table in the center of it, and designed just perfectly for efficiency and for, pleasant environment. And then all the ventilation stacks that let the hot air and the steam out in the middle of the room. Now, all of that's sensible, careful, thoughtful, but this, when you get down to the individual room, that's where he He really, really is thinking hard. So right before he did this competition, Aalto had been in a ski accident. And in this ski accident, he broke his leg really, really badly. And at that point, the treatment was to be in traction. So he was flat on his back in a bed with his leg stuck up in traction for 6 weeks. And it was a horrible experience. But he had just gone through that experience when he started to design this sanatorium. So he said, when you design a place like this, you have to design for a horizontal person instead of a vertical person. So it's very different if you're lying on your back all day than if you're standing up all day. So there were a number of things he did different. Number one, instead of having a color on the walls and maybe having a white ceiling, which is good for a vertical person, he put the color on the ceiling. In the slide on the left, that ceiling is actually kind of a turquoise color. The color's on the ceiling, so when you're lying down and looking up, you can see the more interesting surface of the wall, the ceiling there. Instead of putting the light fixture in the middle of the room, which is oh so common in hospital rooms, so as you're lying and you're seeing the glare of the stupid fixture right there, instead he tucks the fixture up behind the bed and out of your eyesight when you're lying in the bed. He realized from his experience how the slightest little draft can give you a chill. So he designed a window. It's a double-paned window, and it's a casement window where one piece is opening out and the other piece is opening in so that the air can come in that way, but it's always kept off of the patient. So you get ventilation, but you don't get a draft on the patient. He also realized that when you're in bed, the thing that gets the very coldest is your feet. You're not moving around a lot, the blood's not circulating down there, and your feet get cold. Your body's perfectly temperate, and your freaking feet are cold. So he put the heating in the ceiling, radiant heating, at the foot of the bed so that your feet get the heat first. And not blowing air, which is incredibly annoying if you're stationary, but radiant heating where the panel just heats up and it heats that part of the room. So he's thought about the heating, the ventilation, the lighting, the color. He also, these people, when you have tuberculosis, you get phlegm in your throat. And one of the things they would have to do a lot is hawk and spit. So it's like going, you know, and spit out all that phlegm in their throat. And so they would constantly be having to go to the sink to spit. And so he designed a special sink. He was annoyed by the fact that most sinks, you turn on the water, and the water goes down and splashes up at you. So he designed a sink where there was a slow kind of slope on the back of the sink, and the water hit that slope, and it kind of eased into the sink, and it didn't splash. Because these people are using the sink 10, 12, 14 times a day. Why have that annoyance? He designed a better sink for the space. All through the building, there is that kind of attention to the ability to get outdoors. Even if you're being wheeled in your wheelchair out to a terrace, there are terraces all over this place. So you're just not cooped up. You can get outdoors. Bright colors, lots of light, cheerful environments, just to make this a more pleasant place to be, because you're having to spend basically the rest of your life there. Now, that is an amazingly humanistic design. So I went there when I was, in my 20s. And the place was immaculate. I mean, it's an old building, but it's in perfect condition. I didn't speak any Finnish. Nobody at this place spoke any English. I somehow communicated to them that I'd just like to look around at the building. They were fine with that. So they sort of give me the janitor to show me around. And so this guy, for 3 hours, he shows me around every corner. I went to see the boiler in the basement. He wanted to show me everything. Basically, probably didn't want to sweep, so it was better to show me around than doing his job. But he's showing me around. And finally, and he's realizing how interested I am in every little functional thing about the building. And finally, he takes me down to the door that he enters every morning to get into the building, kind of a back door. And he showed me this little cubby that had been designed by Aalto, by the architect. I mean, clearly his hand, just all his woodworking and that kind of thing. But a place for the guy's, you know, boots, snow boots, a place for his jacket, a place for his lunch kit, so that even the freaking janitor, he's thinking about, when I come into work, is there a place for me to take all my things and get all the water off of them and keep them there and make them tidy before I go do my work? And this janitor was like, I just want to show you, he's thinking of me too. He's not just thinking of those patients. He's thinking of everybody in the building. That's really humanistic design. Just to show another building type and how that would be applied in a different way, this is a library that Aalto did at about the same time. Again, he won it in a competition. It's in a small town called Viipuri, which now is Russia, but used to be Finland. There's a big reading room in one part of the building here, that big sort of solid piece, and on the left, that piece right there. And then there is a long, thin piece, and the long, thin piece is the offices for the librarians above, and it's a lecture hall down below. So different functions here. And so he's worried about, all right, we're doing a library. What is it like to do a library? How do I make the very best possible place to read? So he's thinking in particular of light here. And one thing he noticed, and Aalto was a huge reader. He loved to read. And he said that when I read, I'll sit in my chair and I'll get just the most comfortable position and I'll get the book just so there's no glare on the page, just so I can read it perfectly. And then after a while, my body inevitably will want to shift my weight. I mean, it's just human nature. You're not going to stay in exactly the same posture for hours reading. So I start to shift my weight, but oh, now I get glare on the page. And there's kind of just one angle where I don't have glare on the page, and then I want to move my body in it. So there was a conflict there. So he said, can I make a library where there's no glare on the page anywhere? There is completely soft, even light everywhere. So no matter what posture you're in, there's no glare on the page. So you can see his drawings on the left, and he's saying, no reflection over here, no shadow over here, trying to get that light in everywhere around you. So he makes these big 6 foot in diameter skylights all over the top of the space to bounce the light, never direct light. Like I said, it never gets over 52 degrees. So it comes in an angle, it bounces off of that deep skylight, and then it gives this even diffuse light all over the room. And even at night, the light fixtures then take a similar route and they distribute that light very evenly through the space. So no shadow, no reflection. Those big mammoth skylights up there. And the whole library is built around this reading room that, with this very diffuse light, the librarian in the center, this clever thing in the slide on the left where you have two layers of books. One with a kind of sunken reading area and one with the upper reading area. So you get twice as much height that people can reach up and get the books. Very even light on all the books, none of these little creepy, you know, aisles and rows and stacks of books. Much more humanistic way to think about finding the book, seeing the book, getting the book, reading the book, even light all through it. So that was one issue. Then when he got to the lecture hall, it's a completely different issue. Now it's about sound, not about light. And he's worried now, this is before they're very sophisticated PA systems. So the speaker, then being an orator, was about having a big voice that could project to the whole audience. And you're using primarily natural projection. So in this space, he makes this funky ceiling where all of the surfaces that face the speaker are reflective. That's those black lines. They're all reflective. And all the surfaces that face the audience, they're absorptive. So any shuffling or coughing or any noise the audience makes gets sucked up by the absorptive surfaces. everything the speaker says gets reflected down to the rest of the audience through the reflective surfaces. So it conveys very naturally a human voice, not embellished by electronic devices, but a natural human voice to everybody in the room. Again, how do we make this function the very best it can? And it's functioning not just on that technical level, but also emotional level. This is actually not by Aalto, it's by a very close friend of his who he practiced with named Eric Brigman. And this is a funeral chapel. So this is a very vulnerable point in people's lives. And so there's a beautiful cemetery, gorgeous garden, trees, very serene, peaceful environment. He placed the chapel in the middle of that, and then the chapel itself is this very restful, very serene space, very gentle light that creeps in from one side, the form of that arch, very soft, reassuring kind of form. And then all on one side, it's glass, and you just look out to beauty of nature. You know, very quiet, reassuring, serene kind of environment. If you're at a service, you're looking, actually the pews are slightly canted in the room. They're not perpendicular and parallel. So from those canted pews, I can see out to the trees and the forest. I can see up front to the pulpit where somebody is given a eulogy. I can see the body that's placed right there. I can see all the flowers that are in stacks right there. Very carefully orchestrated, so I've got this serene, quieting, comforting environment for the tender moment of a funeral. So the point is, as we're doing with architectural determinism, this notion of humanism works at an emotional, material, visual level. It also works at a very functional room arrangement kind of level. Okay, I ran a little over today. No Twitter card question. So I'll see you in class on Thursday.